You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, super excited to dive into this past week's episode and talk. Actually, I want to go more in depth and talk about dividend investing again, because I think it's a conversation that is worth spending some more time on. And to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I'm doing quite well. Yeah, what's going on in your world?
Well, probably one of the biggest pieces of news in our family is that my wife and I, we are expecting our second child.
Hey, congrats, Jonathan. Obviously, I've known this, but congrats for mentioning it here publicly. It's incredible news. So this summer, right?
Yes. And I was complaining about my sleep habits a few weeks ago.
Exponentially worse, my friend. Exponentially worse.
Absolutely. So, you know, as we're driving as a family, I'm increasingly aware, and obviously you always drive safe, but you know, my wife is, you know, well along the way now. And I'm trying to drive more cautiously, more carefully. Obviously everybody's seatbelts are on, but you're just paying extra attention. And in our neighborhood, Brad, we have a squirrel with a death wish. I mean, it is a kamikaze squirrel. I don't know how to describe this to you better, but we were driving home the other day. You know, I'm driving cautiously, making sure I'm staying in my lane, watching for my surroundings. This squirrel sees us, has plenty of time to seize us, and just jumps right in front of the moving vehicle. Now, in this flash of a second, my mind is torn between, okay, how do I make sure that I don't slam on the brakes so hard that our airbags don't deploy versus make sure this squirrel stays alive. And I made this split second decision, and I may have leaned too far to squirrel safety. And my wife was rather frustrated with me. Oh. So
did the airbags deploy?
No airbags deploy, but fine. We all walk away. It's fine. We go back through the same neighborhood about a week later, and it's that same freaking squirrel. It sees us and it jumps in front of the car again. I swear to you, it's a kamikaze squirrel. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. This squirrel has a death wish, and I don't think I can continue to save it. I don't know how it's still alive.
Wow. I am speechless, Jonathan. I don't think I have anything to respond to other than obviously congrats for the news, and I stay safe and try not to kill any squirrels.
Watch out. Well, talk about hopping in front of a moving vehicle, man. I feel like this conversation with dividends is kind of similar to that, because people are so passionate about it. And this past week's episode with Craig, I mean, first of all, huge thanks to Craig for just being willing to come on the show and share, you know, his take on this and why he gets so excited about it. And some people were listening to it, and many people, I think, just appreciated the episode and the information, but some people said that we seemed like we were skeptical, or maybe the word that was used was dismissive of this tactic. And so I think the real question, Brad, is why do you hate dividends? Do you just hate money?
Oh, Jonathan, please don't go there. No, I certainly don't hate dividends at all. I think there's a time and a place for them, obviously. And I think what I am all about is understanding things and understanding why people are so passionate about different investing strategies. And I think, to me, again, like I mentioned in the episode with Craig, like I've never really understood it. And I wasn't kind of being a jerk. I was just trying genuinely to understand, like basically asking the questions that, as I normally do, that I would want to ask if I was sitting out in the audience.
And I think that's the larger point, right? If you've already decided that dividends are the most perfect investment strategy ever, that they're infallible, that there's no downside for it, like this episode today, I'll be honest with you, is not going to be for you. What we're going to try to do with this episode today is put ourselves in the shoes of a listener, put ourselves in the situation of someone that's exploring different investment opportunities and is trying to decide, okay, this dividend option strategy looks really good, but what is it that I don't know? What is it that I'm not finding when I do searches on Google? What is the information that I'm not going to find in terms of the pros and the cons of this strategy on maybe like a site that's just all in for dividends? This is kind of this devil's advocate perspective. And it's not that you hate dividends or you hate the dividend strategy. It's just that, as with many things, there's a time and place for it. And you just need to be aware of all the factors before you go all in on one hand. And I think that's our objective today.
Yeah, that sounds great. I think that is a very even-handed way to approach this. And just like anything in life, I am always looking to learn more. I think we've seen that over the course of these couple hundred episodes that you and I have put together, that our own thinking has evolved so significantly. We were almost all in, akin to dividend stock investors, with VTSAX and the Total Stock Market Index Fund, right? And then Brian Feraldi comes along and talks to us about the value of individual stock investing. His case was compelling, and I understood it. I think I've always been wary of investing in real estate until I've met people like Chad Carson and Rich Carey and Paula Pant, who made me see this as a business. And I've updated my thinking. I think that's the sign of an intelligent person, is to look at something and say, you know, I don't have it all figured out. I just don't. I need to learn more. And I would say, with me personally, I cannot wait to learn more about dividend stock investing and understand why people are so passionate about this. And I think the best way to do this, Jonathan, is to bring on amazingly intelligent guests. And we have two here today.
Yes. And so, you know, in that episode with Craig, we actually referenced multiple times Brian Feraldi, who we talked about in episode 75, and Big Earn from Early Retirement Now, who we've actually featured several times on the show, talking about sequence of return risk and the value of an emergency fund, and really just kind of going into the data, the raw data. His background is as an economist for the Federal Reserve. This is a guy who understands the numbers and can run the modeling to actually show what these strategies would actually look like for you over any particular time horizon. And honestly, their depth of knowledge is just much deeper than ours when it comes to this 200 level investing stuff. So what we wanted to do today is to have them on the show. We're going to honestly go back through the talking points one at a time with regards to dividend investing. And we're going to try to pick out where dividend investing really shines and where you might want to consider shoring it up. This is not the hate on dividend investing show, but it is taking an intellectually honest look at where it works and where maybe it doesn't quite hold up as much. And I think it's going to be a valuable use of our collective time. So with that, Brian Carsten, AKA Big Earn, welcome to the show.
Hey, Jonathan, Brad, great to be back.
Hi, everybody. Glad to be back. Thanks for having me.
All right, guys, this should be fun. And I just wanted to kind of start out with my own little anecdote. And clearly, you guys are experts, and I'm just trying to understand this. So I want to talk about the concept of a dividend and what it truly is, and also passive income, right? You hear that often when talking about dividends. And I want to get your opinions on this. So just bear with me for a minute here. I guess my kind of holy grail, and even looking at 4% safe withdrawal rates, could I get an income stream that provides me that money, and then I don't need to touch my principal? So let's say, for instance, I put $100,000 in a high yield savings account, okay? And it earns 2%. Let's say it pays out, you know, one time annually, right? So I'm earning $2,000 in interest that year. Pretty straightforward. That's true income. I had $100,000. They paid out. I've got $102,000. I'm doing cartwheels. Everything's great. I've got this passive income, right? That's truly, truly income. Now, I thought it worked the same way with dividends. And maybe this was anecdotal, but I invested in a dividend stock. And guys, you're going to cringe in horror hearing like how little research I put into this, but it was on some hot list and it paid like a 10% dividend. So, you know, knowing what I know now, it's absurd, but these were like $10 per share and it paid a 10% dividend. It's that dividend day. It shows up. I've got my $10. Let's say I own one share. I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to have $11 the next day. And then I looked in my account and I had $10. I'm like, what the heck had just happened? But what happened was the stock price went down to $9 and I got my dividend and my net worth was still $10. So where was my passive income? I was expecting 11 as if this was an interest account, and it wasn't. That was my moment where I'm like, I don't know if this word means what I think it means. You know, it's like a Princess Bride type thing. Like,
I love the reference, Brad.
Guys, am I getting this wrong? Like, is this truly passive income akin to interest, or is this something different entirely?
So I think we should just back up and just define what a dividend is. A dividend is when a company takes cash out of its bank account and gives that directly to its shareholders. Normally, in most cases, that is done directly out of profits. So for simple math, let's say a business earns $100 million per year. Well, it has to decide each year what it's going to do with that $100 million, and it has several choices. One option is to just let it accrue in the bank account, so the company's cash balance goes up. Another option is to use that to reinvest in itself, or it could buy back its own stock. One of those options is to give a portion of that $100 million in net income back to its shareholders in the form of a dividend. So let's say a company had a policy of paying out half of its net income to its investors. It would literally take $50 million and it would give it directly into, it would put it directly into its shareholders' brokerage accounts as a cash dividend payment. So that's what the dividend is. Now, Brad, you were specifically talking about an instance where you looked at a very high yield stock, right? A company was paying out a one-time dividend that equated essentially to 10% of its share price. In that case, it's pretty common for a stock to take a substantial hit on the day that the dividend is paid because so much of its value is going out of the business and into shareholders' pockets. There is no net value creation. And I think that's one of the big knocks that you had against dividend stock investing in general. However, that isn't always the case with every dividend stock. I understand that that's the theory, that if a business is taking that money, giving it back to shareholders, that the business is also going down. However, let's just take that $50 million stock example, where a company's paying out $50 million in net income throughout the year. Typically, they're made quarterly payments. So the company would make a payment every, say, 90 days. Well, that would equate to about $12.5 million every 90 days. But you have to remember that company is simultaneously earning $25 million over that same 90-day period. So wouldn't it also make sense that the stock would go up by $25 million and then by down by 12.5? So the net result should be that the share price would still be higher if the dividend amount was subtracted directly from the share price. So I think that's something that was just missed in the conversation.
Yeah, so I don't have that much to add. The issue is, so first of all, dividends are not guaranteed like a bond interest, right? So this is another distinction, because you brought this up. This is passive income. Can you consider your 10% dividend stock almost like a 10% bond, where you invest a certain amount and then you get 10% interest? And then at the end of the bond maturity date, you get your money back. And unfortunately, that 10% dividend stock differs from that 10% bond in two important ways. There's no maturity date, first of all, on a stock. And even if you sell it after what you consider a maturity date, there's no guarantee that you get that principal back. And then on top of that, there's no guarantee that this company will pay 10% dividends every single year, right? There's been one brilliant example, for example, CenturyLink, right? That was one of the highest yielding dividend stocks around, that paid a 13% dividend. Well, until they decided to no longer pay a 13% dividend, and they cut their dividend in half. So a dividend is very different from interest income on a bond, in that there's no contractual agreement. So it's a company pays a dividend out of good faith because they say, well, we want to give money back to our shareholders, and they are in no way contractually obligated to do that. They can cut the dividend at a moment's notice. They can completely eliminate the dividend at a moment's notice. So this is something to keep in mind. So there is not exactly a one-for-one analogy between a dividend-paying stock and, say, a government bond or even a corporate bond.
And, you know, Brian, I'm going to try and put myself in the situation of just kind of the lay listener that isn't really deep in the weeds of this already. And so that person, they're hearing this. And one of the points that Craig made is it's a simple way, or it's a relatively simple way, of creating an income stream for yourself. And I'm kind of referencing both the points that you and Karsten just made. In your mind, this dividend, is this really income, or is this a forced selling of shares? I think that's kind of like, those are the two different things that we were trying to go back and forth on in the episode. And I don't know if we really nailed that down. What's your perspective on that?
I view it as it is actually income. I mean, when you buy a stock, the business is theoretically making profits. And when the business retains those profits are kept at the business and they benefit you, the shareholder, in a very vague sense. There's no direct link between the company making profits and the share price appreciating. However, when they choose to pay out a portion of that net income directly to shareholders, that is a way for them to realize an immediate cash return on their investment without having to sell anything. So it is kind of a way of taking a theoretical return that they're earning from the net income and turning it into a realized return.
So, Brian, is that just like taking cash off the table while still having the same ownership percentage? Like, I'm thinking of like Mr. Wonderful on Shark Tank, how he's always looking for a royalty to pay him back. Is that even close to accurate?
Yeah. I mean, when a business makes, say, that $100 million per year and retains it as capital, you, the shareholder, theoretically benefit from it, but you don't directly benefit from it. When they pay it out as a cash payment to you, it's taking a portion of the proceeds and making it a realized gain, essentially an income stream for the shareholder without them having to sell. So it is sort of like an interest payment, but to Carson's point, it is by no means promised. It is by no means guaranteed. And one thing I do want to point out is in America, most companies set a dividend policy and then they pay that right out steadily, that they make almost a promise to their shareholders that they're going to pay a steady rate. In a lot of foreign countries, what they do instead of paying out a fixed rate, a fixed number, is to say, we're going to pay out 30% of our profits or some set number. So when their profits go up, they increase the dividend. Conversely, when their profits go down, they lower the dividend. So they are not tied into a specific number like they are in America.
The other aspect that I wanted to talk to is just kind of the simplicity. So to me, this sounds almost the opposite of simple, right? Because there's the aspect of this is kind of you're actively taking on the role of finding great companies. And if you're simultaneously doing that, so you're putting all this research in and then you're not keeping up with the market, but the upshot for you being, well, I've created a steady income stream. Well, possibly if those companies still perform well. I mean, we've mentioned two examples, GE in the episode CenturyLink today, where it doesn't necessarily keep up with that. It kind of seems like you're really putting a lot of emphasis on your own ability to pick these companies as opposed to an index where you're saying, hey, I'm just going to keep up with the market. And then point two on that, if you really like the aspect of bringing some of that capital back to you, right? Bringing something back to you in the form of a dividend, couldn't you just take your index funds and do some form of an automatic sell periodically to then kind of essentially get the best of both worlds, keeping up with the market, which is something that if you're a dividend investor, apparently that's not a huge priority for you as long as you have income. And then two, not having to do all that research. So Vanguard VTSAX has like a 1.9% dividend kind of baked into it, I believe, last time I checked. And then on top of that, if you just combine that with an aspect of a forced share selling process, which you can do pretty easily on the Vanguard platform, couldn't you basically get the best of both worlds?
I definitely agree that even in as your index investor, you get, let's round that up to a 2% dividend yield, right? So you get that in the total stock market index, the S&P 500 index funds, they pay just under 2% dividend yield. So with that 2% dividend yield, you're already there. Say, imagine you're retired and you want to have a 4% safe withdrawal rate. You get the 2% dividend yield automatically already. So you have to still sell a little bit of your principal, and that's the additional 2%. And unfortunately, that 2% historically has been enough to create problems with sequence of return risk, right? Because you have to raise these additional funds by selling principal. And if you sell principal during a recession and a bear market, that's going to be bad from a sequence of return risk point of view. So, but I would say that even if you are this dividend investor and you raise your dividend yield all the way to 3%, 3.5%, 4%, again, that 4% is not guaranteed, right? So there have been cases where dividends have been cut, where even quality stocks have cut their dividend. So the nice link that Craig gave, and I've seen that link before, this is really a treasure trove of information. It's called dripinvestor.org, where they have a list of not just dividend payers, but these are the dividend payers that are the stable dividend payers that have been paying dividends for 10 years, 15 years, 25 years, even some of them 60 years in a row. They have paid dividends and raised their dividends for 60 years in a row. And you go back and look at what were the constituents of these stable dividend payers back in 2007, right? December 2007. And you see really stable companies and very stable dividend payers like Bank of America. Well, and guess what? Bank of America got in trouble during the global financial crisis and they never stopped paying dividends, but they slashed their dividends by, I think, over 90%. So my issue is that with this dividend growth investing, and it's not just dividend investing, but this dividend growth investing and dividend plus quality investing, that it's very hard to determine in real time what is that quality stock that will keep paying this dividend and will not be the hardest hit company in the next recession. So we've seen, say Bank of America got clobbered, obviously, during the global financial crisis.
Couldn't we just look at like the dividend aristocrat list and just go with that? I mean, they've been paying it this whole time. Let's just get those.
Right. If you look at today, who were the dividend aristocrats, and you backfill the data and look at how would they have performed since 2007, they would have performed really well. But the problem is you didn't know back in 2007 which ones are the dividend aristocrats in 2019. So back in 2007, you had all the other quote-unquote crummy stocks. Well, they looked like quality stocks, but they turned out to be not the stable dividend payers. And then they dropped out of that list of stable dividend payers. And of course, that came along with a lower dividends. And then also the stock price itself got hammered, right? As Bank of America, I think they're still at 40 or 45% their peak stock price back in 2007. So with a lot of backward-looking bias, I can come up with a great list of companies that were stable dividend payers over the last 10 years, 20 years. But the problem is we have to do this in real time. We have to determine today which ones are the stocks that will be really stable going forward. And I have a little bit of a story. It's a slightly off topic, but so for example, in 2007,
we're not used to rabbit holes at all on this show.
So back in 2007, I was applying for jobs. I had a stable job at the Federal Reserve and I wanted to move into finance. And I ended up at a company that actually did reasonably well during the global financial crisis. And so I could pat myself on the back. Hey, I'm good at picking stable companies because I not just invested a few thousand dollars in a stock portfolio, but I invested my human capital in a company and I stayed with them for 10 years and I did pretty well. So I could pat myself on the back and say, hey, look at me. I am good at picking stable companies that will make it through the next recession. But I have to also tell you, around the same time, I had interviews with two other companies, and take a guess who they were. They were Lehman Brothers and AIG. So it just so happened that among the three companies, I was either lucky or smart, but I think I was mostly lucky that I ended up at the company that made it all right through the crisis and not with Lehman Brothers, that's the one that went bankrupt, or AIG that almost failed. And that was just within a year of talking to these companies. And I had absolutely no idea how bad things were going to be. And I would have never applied for jobs at unstable companies, right? They looked to me like they were solid companies. I would have accepted an offer from them. And so luckily I went to the company where I eventually worked for 10 years. But so this just tells you it's very hard in real time to determine which ones are the good companies and which ones are the one that will fail over the next 10 years or will get into trouble over the 10 years. And this is equally difficult determining which ones are the companies that will cut their dividends next. So that's just a little aside from me.
No, that's a good one, Carson. And you're really talking about stock picking here, right? And I actually reached out to my friend Brandon from the Mad Scientist because I know he has strong opinions on dividend growth investing. And he said, and I'm going to quote him here, it's stock picking. Dividend investors often feel they aren't stock pickers, but that is exactly what they are. They are picking individual companies and they're taking on unique risk because they feel that certain companies can offer something that others can't. He goes on to say, it's an insane version of stock picking though. Even though I don't do it myself, you can sort of understand why some people try to pick the next Amazon or Google. They're happy risking a tiny portion of their wealth for potentially incredible returns. Dividend investors, however, take on the same unique company risks, but they instead do it for companies that have limited upside potential. A company that returns most of its profits to shareholders through dividends is obviously not focused on growing their company exponentially. I thought that was an interesting take. And Brian, I wanted to throw it over to you because you are someone who made us see kind of the light of the potential of individual stock investing. I'd love to hear your thoughts on what Brandon said and on dividend stock investing and picking those individual companies specifically.
Yeah, I completely agree with essentially what Brandon said and what Carson's saying here. I mean, the dividend aristocrat list, I believe, is a great starting point for shopping if you're interested in dividend stocks. But stock prices and what you are going to earn are always based on what's going to happen in the future. And the future is always unpredictable. I mean, I know on the show that with Craig, he mentioned that he was looking forward to owning Chevron for years and years and years to come. And Chevron historically has been a great company. However, if you believe that the oil market is going to be disrupted by solar panels and the move to electric cars, it's very possible that 10 years from now, Chevron could be in serious financial trouble if oil prices get shocked again. The same thing can be said for utilities. Or think about like consumer packaged good companies like Coca-Cola and Pepsi. These companies sell sugary products. Brad, I don't know about you. Do you let your kids drink soda?
I do not. I actually have a funny story about that. This is hilarious. I have made it almost akin to like smoking in our house to the point where we were at my brother's
wedding.
You're
not even allowed to have a Coke personally, are you?
No, you're going to love this, guys. I had a rum and Coke at my brother's wedding. My daughter, Anna, saw me. She's like, "Daddy, what are you drinking?" I'm like, "It's Coke." She made me spill it out in front of her. So it was hilarious. So Brian, you can keep going.
Daddy, we need to have an intervention.
But I think that's beyond anecdotal. I mean, if you look, I think soda consumption for our children's generation is going to be viewed in a very similar way. So when I look at a company like Coke or Pepsi, personally, I see tremendous risk over the next couple of decades. I personally don't think that they're going to be able to replicate the success that they had over the past 80 plus years because Americans' views on soda consumption is changing. But if you are only looking at the dividend history, you're probably looking and saying Coca-Cola, fantastic business. And it very well could be. But to Carson's point, the data in there is always backward looking. And when you're an investor, you always have to be thinking about the future. And by artificially limiting your universe of investable stocks to those that pay dividends, specifically those with high yields, I completely agree with what Brandon was saying, where you're sacrificing growth and potential long-term gains for income now, which I is a choice that I do not personally think is worth it.
And guys, this actually reminds me of a point that he made, and it's kind of tied to what you guys were talking about, but it was like this interplay of Craig basically saying, and many other dividend investors saying, we don't care if it doesn't keep up with the market. Potentially it could do more, potentially it'd be less, but it's not really our focus. We don't really care as much about the returns as we do about the fixed income. That was shocking to me because you're putting more time and effort in, right? Because you have to research these companies and simultaneously you're willing to accept less returns. And the trade-off for that is that you're going to get this reliable income, but you're not even using that income now. You're reinvesting it to get more of it down the road. So if that's the case, why would you care when ultimately just the fact that you're looking to see what it does down the road indicates to me that what you really want is a total return. And it would just be simpler to then focus on the index fund and focus on a total return and then find a way to provide that fixed income with a strategy that's just based around providing you a fixed income when the time comes. I feel like that's a giant circle, and I'm sorry to overly complicate that, but I have trouble ever hopping in and saying, I want less money, but more consistency. And with that in mind, I'm willing to do three times as much work.
Yeah, so let me jump in here. So I completely agree with that. We should look at total returns. If your dividend growth investment strategy underperforms in total returns, that's definitely a turnoff. But I don't think it's a complete deal breaker. For me, the deal breaker would be that it takes me too much time to monitor this. But if you could find a way to say you automate this, you do this M1 finance account that automatically rebalances, you might even do this with a lot less manual work. But definitely, if the total return of that dividend strategy underperforms, that is a turnoff, but it's not a deal breaker in the following sense. What if you're in retirement and now you care not just about your average returns, but you also care about volatility and drawdowns and basically sequence of return risk? So the one saving grace, I think, for the dividend growth and dividend strategies in general is that one could make the case that maybe they are less volatile. The total returns are less volatile. And because of that, you have not as dramatic drawdowns, and that will help you with sequence of return risk. So you can, you're willing to give away a little bit of your expected total return for a little bit more stability in your portfolio. So this is the one way I would rationalize this dividend growth investing strategy. But I mean, it's a very limited endorsement from my side here because, so for example, it wouldn't be very easily applicable to the person that's just starting out. And this is more applicable to people that are in retirement right now. and not saving for retirement.
Now, I love that. And that was actually where I wanted to go with this. Just because I may have some, on my end, holdups with regards to getting super excited about this, I suspect that there are situations where this is a very viable strategy. And Craig made a few of those points. So one, I think it would be worthwhile for us to talk a little bit about the tax implications. And then two, the who is this for? And you mentioned this, retirees. In your mind, you know, you're saying the 20-year-old, maybe not the best strategy. You're going to care about total returns. Who should start exploring this more? One, I guess you're kind of the Brian type. You have an interest in researching good companies. So you've already got that characteristic. You're kind of bored with the simple path, right? Like, I need more. I want to spend my time jumping in forums and finding out about these companies and checking earnings statements, that sort of thing. What other characteristics would you look for? Age, how close you are to retirement? What other factors would you kind of want to have on the check the box to say, this is a really good candidate for exploring a dividend strategy?
I do understand the allure of dividend growth investing for a couple of reasons. I mean, one thing that Craig pointed out on the show is that he's got about, I think it was like $9,000 in income coming in, and that's depending on whether he works or not. So you can imagine the situation where a recession comes along, you lose your job, and your stock portfolio gets smashed at the same time. You could theoretically use that $9,000 in dividend income to fund some of your lifestyle while the capital, the stock prices in your portfolio have been just hammered, right? That would be a terrible time for you to go about selling those stocks. So I understand that allure. I also understand that if you can theoretically get your dividend yield up to 3% or even 4%, then you can fully fund your retirement without having to sell anything. And if that 4% is, or 3 or 4% is predictable during all phases of your retirement, I understand the reason that you do not care about whether or not you beat the market, because that income is meeting your needs. So I understand the allure there. To me, if you are interested in dividend growth investing, you have to, it's a requirement to just be, first off, interested in the topic. The simple way to go is always the index fund. That is no thinking, no research, no nothing. It's just buy this thing. And oh, by the way, if you do an index fund, you are a dividend investor. You are getting a 1.9% yield right now off of the VGSAX. So you are an income investor just by the sheer fact of buying the index fund. So the question is there an additional benefit to you for buying your own stocks, your own dividend stocks, beyond what you're already getting from the index? So that has to really appeal to you for you to take the time to research and buy your own individual stocks.
Yeah, so I agree with that. So again, we want to put some numbers on this. So for example, broad index probably has around a 2% dividend yield. The Vanguard, for example, has an ETF that's a high dividend yield ETF. That gets you to about, I think, 3.2% yield. But that comes with the caveat. So one big component of that one is, for example, CenturyLink, right? This is the company that just had to slash its dividend by half. And there are also some other ETFs that replicate these dividend aristocrats or dividend champions or dividend challengers or whatever they're called. So there's an ETF by PowerShares. It's Noble, N-O-B-L, ticker. And so the other one is a State Street Spider ETF. That's SDY. So these two funds, they have this additional quality screen. So they not blindly invest in high dividend stocks. They invest in the stable dividend payers. But guess what? They only get you very slightly above 2% dividend yield, right? And so even if you are now a dividend stock picker and you look at all of the constituents of the dividend aristocrats, you'll be very hard pressed pushing that dividend yield to even 3% or definitely not much above 3%. If you want to push it all the way to 4%, you would basically be concentrated in just a handful of stocks. And it would be AT&T, for example, Verizon. And so, you're taking on some extremely concentrated stock risk. I would not recommend that. So it's basically a numbers game. So you will have trouble getting to a 4% safe withdrawal rate just with your dividend growth investment portfolio. And even then, again, so there is the caveat. So these are companies that have been paying stable dividends. There is no guarantee that they keep paying stable dividends. So you don't even get all the way to the 4%. And even with your quote unquote measly 2.9% dividend yield, you still have this caveat that, well, maybe some of them are going to fall out of that elite list of dividend payers. And you can imagine what happens to the stock price if they do. And then even if the dividends are raised very marginally, they could be eroded away by inflation. So there's still a lot of caveats. And so in my view, the numbers here are working a little bit against the dividend investors for just purely for retirement.
Yeah, Carson, that makes sense. And I want to just drill down on this a little more and ask each of your opinions. So let's set up two hypotheticals. I'll just start with the first one here. You've got a 30-year-old who is new to FI. They're not in debt. They have maybe a little bit of savings. They're looking to invest and have the highest net worth possible when they're 50. Obviously, this is all guesswork, but you know, expected value, like, you know, just do whatever calculations you would do in your own head of what would give them the highest likelihood of the highest net worth 20 years down the road. Is it something like index fund investing, which there's potentially more growth, or would you counsel this dividend aristocrat or dividend growth investing? Like, I know I'm kind of setting up an artificial binary choice because I think the answer is probably somewhere in between there. But if you were just looking at it as a pure, those are your only two choices, what do you think would give you the highest likelihood of having a successful net worth and therefore early retirement?
Index funds.
Index funds. So let me, do you want to elaborate more on that?
Yeah, if you want to.
I mean, the real answer is not enough information provided, right? We don't know how interested this person is. We don't know what their risk tolerance is. We don't know what their plans are. But
you guys didn't say Bitcoin.
Yeah. I take it back. I changed my answer. To me, index funds are the right choice for the vast majority of people the vast majority of time. I personally use index funds in my retirement accounts, but you guys know that I'm also a big proponent of growth stock investing on an individual basis. I do that because I have an extreme interest in this subject, and I've been practicing, and I'm willing to do all the research it takes to try and beat the index. But I know that most people are not interested in doing that and have no desire to do so. So for them, the simple thing to do is to just do index funds. That's a very logical choice for the vast majority of people.
I agree with that. Let me add another few sentences here. Remember the Choosify episode when I first came on in 35? It came to the issue mortgaging your retirement. So when you're young and you're starting out and you have zero net worth, especially in stocks, you want to get your butt moving as quickly as possible to accumulate as much equity net worth as possible. You probably want to be 100% equity. So don't even fiddle around with 80-20 or 60-40. Get as much equity exposure as you can get because it reduces sequence of return risk. So you want to be invested, you want to be diversified, not just within your portfolio, but also across time, right? So you want to have your equity exposure for as long as possible. So you smooth out recessions versus expansions, bear markets versus bull markets. So that means you almost want to go in the stock market almost with leverage. So of course, lots of people don't want to do that with literally and explicitly leverage. So one way would be, for example, if you have a mortgage at the same time, don't rush paying off your mortgage, pay off only the minimum on your mortgage and get your equity portfolio as high as possible, as quickly as possible. Maybe not with leverage explicitly, but implicitly by keeping around, say, a mortgage or other low interest rate loans and get your equity portfolio up as quickly as possible to give you the widest possible range of equity exposure over time. So at that time, I don't think that you really need the safety of this dividend growth investment that has, say, lower volatility and lower drawdowns. There could be even some reasons why a drawdown is good for you, right? So you buy highly discounted stocks on a sale. And everybody who heeded that advice, right, they would have invested heavily in December 2018 when stocks were on sale. So in that sense, when you are just starting out as an investor, in some way, volatility is good for you. And so don't worry too much about the income. And the other issue, of course, is the taxation, right? You would have to potentially pay income tax on your dividends. If you're a high income earner, you're in the third federal tax bracket, you pay 15%. You potentially pay the Obamacare additional taxes. If you're a really high income earner, you potentially pay up to 10% or so state income tax in California. You want to defer as much of that to when you're retired, when you're in a lower tax bracket and in a lower income tax state. So if you're young and you're a high earner, don't do the dividend growth investing yet. Or if you do it, you would do it in a tax-deferred account, definitely not in a taxable account. But again, just to keep it simple, maybe you do the index investing and just be done with it.
Yeah, that's great. And obviously, I set up kind of a silly example there. And Brian Riley said, not enough information. That's clearly the answer. But I think the more nuanced conversation is, and Carson, I would throw this right back to you, as someone ages and they are getting closer to those withdrawals, how do you see that change the game here in terms of this dividend investing strategy?
Yeah, so the dividend investing strategy, the tax inefficiency while you're still working is that you have to pay income taxes on the dividends every year, and that's a drag on your returns. And you actually compound that drag by having to pay income taxes on, say, a 3 or 4% dividend yield every year instead of the 2% dividend yield in your S&P 500 index fund. So that could accumulate over time. And then on top of that, you're more likely to have lower income taxes in retirement. So again, once you reach retirement, you don't have this problem anymore of income taxes compounding, because you're now at a stage where you're going to withdraw your dividends anyways, right? You use those as cash flow, potentially supplement that a little bit with selling some principal. And then out of that principal, part of it is cost basis and part of it is hopefully long-term capital gains. So you're going to pay income taxes on this anyways, whether you pay the income tax on the capital gain or on the dividend. Right now, they're taxed at the same rate. So in retirement, I could see that both from a tax point of view, it's no longer prohibitive to have this dividend growth strategy. And then also from an asset allocation point of view, where you want to be a little bit more conservative, you have the low volatility, the lower volatility or lower beta stocks potentially in your dividend portfolio. But there's one problem. What if you have accumulated in your taxable account purely in an index portfolio, say S&P 500 or VTSAX, and now you want to shift to a dividend portfolio? You'd have to then liquidate your portfolio with a lot of built-in capital. So you can't do it. You can't do it either. So in that sense, that switch from VTSAX into a dividend portfolio, again, that's another reason to do that inside a tax-deferred account, because then there you can sell your highly depreciated VTSAX or your highly depreciated, say, Fidelity large-cap index fund, and then put it in your dividend stocks and then live off of that. So it's not going to work in your taxable account, because then you owe some huge tax bill.
Yeah, and Carson, talking about the taxes, actually, Warren Buffett, in his 2012 letter to shareholders, had a really interesting, maybe the most interesting explanation of his own dividend strategy on page 19 through 21 here.
You actually know the page numbers? Please tell me you have it pulled up.
I've referenced it so many times. It's amazing. He's saying the second.
Let me just keep laughing for a few seconds longer. Let me have this. Yep. No,
I've earned it. So the second disadvantage of the dividend approach is of equal importance. He's saying the tax consequences for all taxpaying shareholders are inferior, usually far inferior, to those under the sell-off program. He's talking about selling off shares versus getting dividends. So he's actually in favor of the sell-off program. And this is Warren Buffett, obviously. He said, under the dividend program, all of the cash received by shareholders each year is taxed, whereas the sell-off program results in tax on only the gain portion of the cash receipts. And this is interesting, right? There's underlying basis on the equities that you're selling, whereas 100% of the dividend is taxed, only a tiny fraction of that is taxed in the sell-off approach. So just an additional layer of nuance here.
And that actually, I wanted to bring up two points that you made, and I just wanted to slow down on it for a second. One was actually the tax treatment. Maybe we could go through where that is so people kind of know those numbers. But it sounded like you were making the case dividends and capital gains effectively treated the same. So when someone talks about the tax benefits of dividends, you're getting the same benefit through a capital gains approach as well. That was one point. And then two, actually dialing in on what you were saying about how to make this transition. So this individual is listening to this. They've been just following a growth strategy. They've just been putting everything they can into an index fund. It's been growing. And as they get older and closer to retirement, not right at the day of retirement, but as they get closer, they start wanting this idea of having regular income coming in, companies paying you out, not having to rely on the actual process of selling shares. It starts to hold more and more appeal, and they want to start getting some of those benefits. What would be an elegant way of doing that? Essentially bridging the gap, getting the best of both worlds. Karsten, your thoughts?
Yeah. So, I mean, the most elegant way is to do it in the tax deferred accounts. And
so a lot 401k, of
401ks, Roth, 403bs, if they allow that. If it's not within your 401k, say you leave work and you could roll over your 401k into an IRA then you roll it over to Fidelity or Vanguard or Schwab or some brokerage company. And then you can obviously sell your index funds without any tax consequence in that tax deferred account and construct your own dividend growth portfolio. Another option would be, say, for example, sometimes people leave from work and they get some kind of a settlement payment, a big lump sum. Well, I mean, yeah, of course, put that big lump sum into your dividend growth portfolio. Or you have still some severance pay while you're transitioning into retirement, and then you could reinvest the dividends from your taxable account that come out of ETSAX and put that into a dividend growth portfolio. Again, I mean, I would never do the complete transition because there could be tax consequences, and you would have to do this on a case-by-case basis. You could be in a low enough tax bracket where you could do big chunks. Say you are married, filing jointly, you can have up to $100,000 of income. So that's the standard deduction plus the first two tax brackets. Maybe your budget is only $40,000. You could do the additional $60,000 and then do basically what's called tax gain harvesting, right? So you harvest the gains tax-free. So you take $120,000 of your portfolio, it has $60,000 built in gains. You sell that and then use these $120,000 and buy a dividend growth portfolio. You do that for a few years, you can definitely gain some traction even in a taxable portfolio. And it may not even take you that many years to do that. There are some other people that have, for example, I have one account where I have a very high cost basis. So I could transition some money out and then build a dividend portfolio with that. I have basically, just for full disclosure, I have started my own little dividend growth investing strategy. And I put some, I think I put something like $10,000 or $15,000 into that. It's just, it's more than play money, but it's not going to make or break my retirement. Yeah, again, so you take some high cost basis assets and you sell them with basically zero capital gains.
So when you say high cost basis, this is a stock that you've held for a long time, potentially that has gone up significantly in value, and you're using the margin and the tax brackets to allow you to claim that new value without, and saying, hey, government, you can tax me, but because your income's so low, they're like, you're fine. We're not going to, we'll tax you, but your tax rate's zero.
My situation is slightly different. I don't want to get into the details, but I have one account where I hold a lot of money as margin cash for some derivatives transactions that I do every week. And I'm not going to get into the details there.
Well, that feels like a rabbit hole.
It's going to be another kind of rabbit. Talk about rabbit hole.
Maybe next week.
And let's throw it over to Brian. Yeah.
But I mean, I could take some
suddenly
of that
me buying Amazon doesn't sound so crazy, does it?
No, but I could take some of that high cost basis. So if I take that money out of $100 that I transition over, $199 of that is cost basis, and only $1 of that is long term capital gain. So that's not going to hurt me on my tax bill. So I could always shift over a little bit of money from there. Again, I'm just doing this dividend growth investing as a little bit of a side project. I'll probably write a blog post about that at some point in the future. And it has been doing reasonably well, but I probably wouldn't want to do my entire portfolio.
Really enjoying the video on this, man. I'm feeling like we got a little thing going on here. This is
yeah,
working.
Cool.
So my kind of the natural follow-up to this was, because we were kind of tying it to, as you get closer and you actually are looking for more just consistency, fixed income, this starts to have more appeal. So I guess in my mind, is this potentially for the interested party, is this a better alternative to bonds, or should those not be compared? Like, I mean, I kind of find it hard to compare index funds to dividends. It just seems like you're going for two different things. But for the person that is looking, making a choice between bonds and dividends, I get it to some degree. Bonds kind of do nothing. They just kind of sit there. What do you think, Brian?
I think that is a part of the appeal of them. I mean, a high dividend stock could be sort of akin to buying a bond in the sense that you're getting an immediate return on your investment. And if that's the case, you don't really, I understand the argument. I don't care if I beat the market as long as I get the income that I'm expected. But as we've already discussed, a dividend is not set in stone guaranteed.
Because it could disappear. The company could go away. It's consistent until it doesn't exist. I mean,
right. Exactly. You're still getting into individual company risk when you talk about a dividend stock, the same way you are with any individual stock investing. So there is a, I understand that there is an income and there is a sort of hybrid stock bond portfolio thought with some of these dividend payers. However, you just have to remember that dividends are not set in stone. Dividends are not guaranteed. Even companies that pay dividends for decades upon decades are not guaranteed to continue doing so in the future. So when you're buying dividend stocks, you do have to focus on business quality. You do have to think through long-term what the business is going to be like. You do have to think about growth drivers. You do have to focus on all the same things that you do for an individual stock that does not pay a dividend. So you are going through a tremendous amount of extra work. And to me, that is only worthwhile if you are buying a dividend stock, earning a higher yield, and you go on to be the market. I say hats off to you. Dividend growth, invest as much as you want. But to me, if you are not beating the market and you are ending up poorer over the long term, I don't understand. I don't get that trade-off.
I think Jonathan raised a really important issue. So what about your bond portfolio? So the average person in the FIRE community, if you're still saving for retirement, yeah, go ahead, knock yourself out. You could do 100% equity portfolio and you could ride this maybe all the way till retirement or maybe at least close to retirement. But then when people are retired, they are probably a little bit more risk conscious. And they, again, if they want to do this very passive index-based approach, then they're going to say, well, now I want to shift my equity portion down to anywhere between 60 and 80%. And then the rest of it is bonds. And so I think here is one potential selling point for this dividend growth investor. And that's, so imagine you are this average retiree and you say, well, 60% equities is all I want to do because I'm just way too scared about drawdowns and equity volatility. I would like to have this 40% bond allocation in my portfolio. So here, Big Earn comes in, and I can show you.
I love that when Big Earn refers to himself in the third person. It's like the best part of my day.
It's the first time I ever do that, and you picked up on that.
Just so keep here, doing it. Just promise me you'll keep doing it.
So here I come in, and so Big Earn comes in and says, well, what if I told you that this dividend growth investment approach has something that looks like a bond portion? So I ran some statistical analysis, and I ran that on this ETF, SDY. That's that Dividend Aristocrats ETF by Spider, State Street. If you run this statistical analysis called a factor model, and you see what kind of a statistical bond exposure would you have with this Spider ETF, it gets close to 40%. So you have something like a 30. It looks and it feels like a 35% exposure to U.S. government bonds. Of course, you don't have that explicitly, but you run this analysis and you run it through the 2008-09 bear market, and it still holds up that you have a fund that is an equity fund, but it has some quote-unquote built-in bond exposure. And it makes sense, right? Because it's a stable dividend payer. So they are a little bit more conservative stock. So they don't have, they are not 100% stock factor analysis exposure. They don't have a 100% stock beta, but they have some bond beta built into it. And so for the average person who says, well, 60% equities is all I can do, and then the rest I want to have in bonds, and while bonds are kind of yielding very low interest right now, that could be a selling point for somebody. And we could tell this person, well, you already have some bond exposure built into your equity portion. So you could be more comfortable raising that equity portion in your portfolio because you have the bond exposures through the back door. Now, of course, the caveat here is that there is no guarantee that this will continue, right? It's a statistical analysis, and
performance may not be indicative of future success.
Performance is not indicative of future performance. Exactly. This is not guaranteed bond exposure, but it feels like bond exposure. And if you're comfortable with that, so this might be a way of raising your equity portion, because you could tell yourself, well, look, I mean, this is an equity fund, but it has less drawdown risk, it has less stock beta, and it has a little bit of built-in and backdoor bond exposure. So this is what I think is the saving grace for this dividend growth investment strategy, is that maybe you don't beat the stock index in a total return point of view. But again, so there are many other return statistics that we should look at. So drawdowns, equity beta, bond beta, skewness. You're worried about negatively skewed returns in stocks. So there are many other features that we should look at, not just the average total return. And if you could give up a little bit of that total return and you gain some other attractive features, it might be a trade-off worth undertaking.
Cool. Yeah. So definitely it's kind of like as you piece together your predisposition to already want to do dividends. Like I'm looking for a reason to do dividends and I'm trying to figure out where they could fit into my model. You're getting closer to retirement or leaving a steady income stream. You're looking for a little bit less volatility. You have an interest in learning more about individual companies and investing in those companies. This could be a nice counterpart to bonds.
That's right.
Awesome. Guys, is there anything else that we should cover? Anything else that we missed? Yeah, I don't want to leave anything on the table. Really, what we wanted to do is just kind of an exploratory. We have the benefit of hindsight, right? We did this episode. We really tried to be thorough, but I know we missed stuff. What did we miss? What could we have done better? What else should people know about dividends as they are looking into this further? Brian.
Yeah, I want to bring up one topic that hasn't been discussed here, which is a term called yield on cost. And that is the concept of when you buy a dividend stock, or let's say you put $1,000 into a dividend stock and its yield initially is 1%. So you're getting, in that case, $10 in income. Well, if that company continues to raise that dividend at a rapid pace over the years, the dividend can eventually double and then quadruple and then et cetera. And one way that dividend investors think about that is the dividend yield that they're receiving on their cost basis. So it is a way, it is an alternative way to think about dividend investing, where down the road, if you're investing, again, that $1,000 and that dividend over, say, 10 years goes up eightfold, you could be getting an 8% yield on your cost. So that is just another term that I want to throw out there that some dividend investors do think of.
Cool. Guys, thank you so much for coming on the show, being so generous with your time and really helping us explore this further. I mean, I know personally, my knowledge base has been expanded as a result of this conversation. And Brad, I'm sure you would say the same.
Unquestionably. Thank you both for the time. It's been really, really helpful.
Always happy to come on. Thanks for having us, guys.
Thanks, guys. Good luck.
Brad, I was so excited about how this conversation actually came together. You know, obviously on a personal level, me and you, we don't have anything personally invested one way or the other. What we are is we are question askers and we're curious. Like if the information is compelling and there's an obvious play there, we want to know it for ourselves and we want to share it with our community. And obviously, like, there's nothing inherently wrong with dividends, right? I mean, me and you personally are big proponents of index funds, and index funds in many cases have a dividend attached to it. It's just like, if you are going to go all in on dividends, it seems like you should be aware of a few things. One, you're actively picking companies that you think will be successful over the next decade or longer, right? And potentially a subsection of those companies could do worse or could not exist. You need to be aware of that, right? I mean, it's just that's table stakes for doing it. And you need to be confident that those companies will actually be there 5, 10, or 15 years from now. It's not a guarantee. And so, you know, my kind of larger point is if you're going to take all of the time and energy into investigating these companies and picking companies that you believe will be successful over this stretch period of time, it would be nice to at least be able to keep up with the market, if not do better than the market. Because, you know, plan A, at least for me personally, is just keep it simple. I'm barely going to do any additional research. I'm not going to follow these companies individually. I'm just going to throw as much as I can at a broad-based, low-cost index fund for as long as possible. That's an incredibly simple path. Dividends, it's more than a hobby. It's more than a pastime. It requires significant research and investment of your time. But that's not to say it's not good or that it shouldn't be explored. And I loved how Brian and Karsten were able to kind of give us examples of where it might actually make sense. Really appreciate them coming on the show.
Yeah, it's always wonderful to have real experts come on and talk us through this. So like you said, we don't have opinions, deep-seated opinions about this. We just want to learn more. And I think that's the crucial part here. And for me, my overriding goal, and Jonathan, yours could be different. Every listener's could be different, right? That's the beauty of what we've set up here at Choosify, is there's no dogma. There's no I'm right, you're wrong. That's not how we roll here. But my personal bias is I want to have the highest net worth that I can. And for me, I don't need current streams of income right now. So like, I don't care about the dividends right now. I care about the growth. So that's why my personal bias
is to put my money in the total stock market index fund, because I think that is going to give me, from just a betting perspective, the highest likelihood of having the highest net worth, let's say 20 to 30 years from now. Now, for someone who doesn't agree with that or has a different opinion or needs the income now, well, they can obviously have a different strategy, and they should, right? So there's very rarely in life black and white. And I think that's the important point here, right? Is that this is going to depend. The answer always depends. But how can we bring this information to the audience? How can we ask the right questions? So again, if you're listening to this and you want more, you had additional questions, we can ask them of Carson and Brian and bring them back on the show, have them send in a voicemail, whatever it may be. But this doesn't have to be the end of the topic, certainly.
And you know, the one thing that they said that really appealed to me, to be honest with you, Brad, and I'm not sure about you, I don't know if you've actually officially stated this, but I'm 100% equities. I do not have any bonds. Now, I'm not advocating that necessarily for anybody else, but I have a pretty long investing horizon. Right now, it makes sense for me. Bonds have never held any appeal for me. And that could be a component of the fact that I'm still relatively young. As you get older and you get closer to actually exiting the workforce and relying on steady streams of income, you can see how that might actually change. I suspect that as I get closer to that point in time, this idea of providing and getting good companies that provide regular yield, regular income, that starts to look more and more attractive. And I start to understand that, but it doesn't preclude me. As Earn was saying, he kind of gave us a way or a framework to get the best of both worlds. In this time horizon that I'm in now, I want to get total return. And I have 5, 10, 15, 20 years, whatever that may be. And as I get closer, maybe within that 5-year window, whatever, and I'm making the choice between maybe, as J.L. Collins was talking about in episode 34 of our podcast, softening the ride, right? So you have like a bond to equity portfolio and you have your allocation all set up, you know, whether it be 80-20 or 60-40 or whatever else. As I'm starting to make more of those decisions, you know, I could see myself circling back to this and saying, is there a way that I could take a portion of my income that's all in equities, move it over in a tax-advantaged way, and invest more in some of these companies that provide a very reliable yield? That's a very interesting concept to me. It's not one that I need to grapple with right now, but I can see how other individuals, why they would be very interested in that. And I think there's maybe something there. And it's interesting to see that Big Earn is even dabbling with some of this as well. So a lot of great points made on this episode. Certainly, this is something that many people in the community feel strongly about. And I hope that this episode both highlighted some of the strengths of this approach and also maybe brought up some questions that are worth exploring more for people that are going down that path. All right. Now, unfortunately, that's going to bring this episode to a close. Now, as you know, we like to finish every episode by doing a drawing for a copy of a book that we have found useful. And there's three books that we offer. The first is J.L. Collins' book, The Simple Path to Wealth. The second is Dominic Cortuccio's book, Design Your Future. And the third book from Vincent Puglisi, Freelance of Freedom. If you want to enter the drawing, all you need to do is just go to chooseify.com/iTunes, follow the instructions there and leave us a short written review, and then send us an email to feedback@chooseify.com, letting us know that you left a review and what screen name you left it under. We give away one book for every 5 written reviews that we get, and we announce the winner on the Friday roundup. And Brad, how many winners do we have today?
All right, Jonathan, we have 2 winners today. And the first winner is Nathan. Nathan called this the best podcast ever. I love this podcast. I stumbled upon an interview with Brad and Jonathan on YouTube in 2018, which led me to their website and podcast. I've been hooked on their content ever since. Really appreciate the way these guys unpack personal finance. This podcast has really sparked excitement in me, which is rubbing off on my family and friends. Thank you, Jonathan and Brad, for all you're doing for the FI community. All right, Jonathan, and winner number 2 is Jack.
And Jack says, once in a lifetime find. Let's start by saying I am an older guy, so early retirement will be normal retirement. Too bad I didn't know about this years ago. The advice from this program has been the best retirement planning I have ever heard in my lifetime, and I'm already seeing the positive results in my retirement plan. And as a bonus, I get next to free vacations. I never dreamt any of this was possible and was really convinced I would work for the man forever and take average man vacations. Because of this show, there is a plan to retire in 9 years at 62 with no social security draw and take a once in a lifetime trip to Fiji. Thank you, Brad and Jonathan, for what you guys do. All right, guys, thank you so much for being with us today. If you're listening to this for the first time and this was overwhelm, well, you could certainly listen to our episode on Monday, episode 122. But honestly, if you're just discovering the FI community, why start here? Go back, check out episode 100 of our podcast. It is the perfect place to start. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth one life hack at a time.